Claire, you've spoken to other interviewers about setting being critical for your stories. May we begin with you telling me about your family and how your upbringing influences your writing story set in, as the New Yorker online called it, Nevada Gothic?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I was born in Bishop, California, which is on the west edge of Death Valley National Park. I grew up on the southern edge of Death Valley in the Mojave Desert in a really small town called Tecopa, California, about 100 people. And then later my family moved to Pahrump, Nevada, just across the state line there. It was a slightly bigger town, but still pretty rural, pretty remote. Both of my parents and then after were interested in the natural world. They were amateur geologists and natural historians. They ran a rock shop and a museum dedicated to the Death Valley area and the Mojave Desert, and I grew up with them telling me stories about the desert landscape and with them sort of curating this storytelling culture in me, I think. You know, a big part of when you're a rural person, especially in the West, long portions of your life are spent in the car. So there would be a lot of storytelling in the car about what we were seeing, what the valley was and the mountains were and how they came into being. And I think this kind of sunk in with me and resonated, so that years later, that's kind of the approach I took to writing fiction, was starting by asking, where are we, and then who are we, and then what kind of trouble we might get into there. So that's kind of where I start with setting, and then character, and then plot comes from those two converging that way.
Mm-hmm. Your book of short stories, Battleborn, would you explain the title? And I'd like to just know how you would describe the book personally.
The title, Battleborn, sort of an unofficial motto of the state of Nevada. It's on the state seal, on the flag, and it refers to the fact that Nevada became a state during the Civil War. In the book, it's kind of used, in my mind, as kind of an organizing metaphor for the tension in the book, which often is, it comes between the space between two extreme states of being. So the kind of violence and conflict suggested by battle, and then this rebirth or emergence, or sometimes efforts towards those, at least in the idea in this Born. So the characters are born into a landscape that is itself kind of battle-born, full of violence but also beauty. And they're also born of it often, I think, that there's kind of this, I don't know, I mean, this like you said, I'm blessed that a lot of people have mentioned the book and have opinions about it. The ones that usually resonate with me are the ones that note that kind of, I guess, transcendent or at least hopeful uplift in the stories. A lot of times, the descriptions that surprise me are ones that call it bleak or gritty. I think that it's a little bit, I hope it has a little bit more depth than that, and then a little bit more complexity. You know, I never wanted to write a book that was grotesque or one-dimensional or simple about rural people or the desert or what kinds of happenings occur therein.
As I mentioned to you, I left Battleborn on my bedside table, and so I am remiss in remembering a particularly vivid character who's only sort of referred to by her name, and I'm going to get it wrong. Is it Razorblade Baby?
Uh-huh, that's right.
And the story that Razorblade Baby is in turns out in a very heartwarming way.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I think a lot of the characters are kind of struggling to understand each other and to be understood, despite the fact that they're often really isolated, you know, sometimes geographically, but oftentimes just simply emotionally. They feel alienated or alone, you know, as we like so often do. But they, I think it's important to me at least that they do something about that, even though sometimes what they do is a really bad idea or sometimes their efforts are completely ruined and for nothing. But the thing about them is that they want to be understood by other people and engage in humanity, which I think in my mind is kind of a counter narrative to one that's often told about the American West, which is that it's a place of rugged individualism and isolation and indifference. You know, even the landscape itself is often described as being indifferent or uncaring. All landscape is indifferent and uncaring, right? Like the woods in Pennsylvania where I live as are indifferent and uncaring as the Mojave Desert. But there's something about the way we our sort of fears play out in the landscape of the American West. And I wanted to, I think, look at that a little bit and ask if that really all there is, you know, this like John Wayne masculinity. What if there was a character who had grown up as a man in the West and had been kind of enacting that masculinity his whole life, and what would it take to, for him to come up against the limits of those, for example?
Well, let's move into the story, The Past Perfect, The Past Continuous, The Simple Past, that is in Battleborn and has some quite outrageous people in it and a quite outrageous framework and a very unexpected ending. Would you speak to this story?
This story is set in a brothel in Nevada. In all of the rural counties of Nevada, prostitution is legal, including the county where my hometown is. So I grew up down the road from a couple legal brothels. I learned to parallel park at a brothel, in fact. And I was always curious about them. I mean, I've always sort of been drawn to architecture as a, I don't know, it makes me curious when I see an interesting looking building or place, right? So the brothels near my hometown, one of them is really, really interesting looking. It looks like no other building in our town in that it's stick built, it's in the Victorian style, it's painted pink and lavender and has flower boxes. It looks like a bed and breakfast or something, you know? But there's no buildings like that in my hometown in Pahrump, Nevada. So, of course, when I was a young girl, my school bus used to drive past the building, and I was really fascinated by it. And I wanted to live there, of course, when I was very young, because it looked like such a wonderful pink and purple house, right? I continued to be really curious about it after I realized that it maybe was not such a great place to live. So I wrote this story kind of from the perspective of the madam, who is a gay man, who is in charge of the brothel, and then also this Italian tourist whose his friend gets lost in the desert. And so those are kind of the two fulcrums of the story.
Well, I don't even know how you weave the peacocks into this.
Oh, you're right. The peacocks came because I had a neighbor when I was growing up who, I mean, a neighbor in rural Nevada terms is like, you know, a couple miles down the road. And she raised peacocks, and you could hear them cawing. And they have, I don't know if you've ever heard that, mm-hmm. but they have a very loud, piercing, haunting mm-hmm. kind of cry. And they can often sound like a baby crying or a person, which is sort of eerie to hear across the desert. So that was an image along with this dollhouse of a building. That was an image that came to me. And it's also a bit of a nod to Flannery O'Connor, who raised peacocks.
For sure. So you've got Manny, the madam, mm-hmm. Tending the former owner's peacock coop lovingly, mm-hmm. and then the Italian tourist and he have a confrontation in the peacock coop. Mm-hmm. Would you read me that part?
Sure. Let's see. Let me find a good place to begin. The peacock coop is shaded from the pink purple of dawn by palm leaves and canvas overhead. The air is thick with the scents of seed and dust and bird. The boy hesitates before coming inside. These are your pets, not mine, my boss's. I hear you're headed out of town. You're leaving. Yes, I go back to Italy. And you think you're taking Darla with you? She would like to leave. She has told me. A bird rustles in its nest. I like Darla. I liked her too, says Manny. I love her. Honey, I know. But she didn't love you, okay? She does, he says, though he says it like a question. American girls, you don't know how they are. All they care about is money, okay? Especially these girls. Don't you know? It's all business, even with Darla. Where is she? Manny combs his fingers through a trough of seeds, letting the breeze winnow away the empty shells. Don't worry about it. Tell me, where is she? This is a business, kid. She had somewhere else to be. There is a stillness pulled tight between them. Outside, dawn lightens the landscape, but the last dregs of night linger in the coop. They found your friend, didn't they? Michele picks at the chicken wire. Yes. Then quickly, no. They say he is dead. They stopped looking. He turns away and hooks his fingers through the chicken wire. His broad shoulders start to tremble. He begins to shake the entire wall of the coop back and forth, harder and harder, until Manny fears he might snap the old 2x4s. The birds, startled from their roosts, squawk and dart around, frenzied, among them the bright albino flash of white pine. All the while, Michele wails, a feral, guttural sound.
Well, if that doesn't make a listener want to pick up this story, I don't know what will.
And I saved some. I saved some at the end there for you, too.
That's really good. Thank you for that. I'd like to sort of move to what you told one interviewer, that reading Melville has given you permission to be digressive and strange in your own novel, to get freaky and march off in directions I don't understand, rather than making safer decisions. Is that notion something that you can teach? You're a professor at Bucknell University. Do your students understand this as well?
I think they do. I think that they can sense when they're going in a direction that's a little bit safer and then one that is not as safe, is scarier. And a lot of times my job is really fun because I get to just sort of say, no, go towards that weird thing, the thing that you don't understand, you know. When a lot of times I'll come to my office hours and be like, you know, I know exactly what I want to write. It's this and this and this, except this weird thing keeps happening. And I'm like, yep, I know you don't want to hear this, but that's the thing you have to write. You know, that's where you have to take it. If you write something that you have a hold of, you know, that you have like completely in control, it usually, I think, ends up being a bit dead on the page, unfortunately. And the thing that really gives a story life and energy is that process of writing into the unknown. So, you know, I think sometimes they think I'm a bit of a sadist, but I'm always making them go towards that strange stuff that they don't quite have a tight grasp on, because I think that's where the really magical stories come from.
It's my impression that you are well into a novel now. Will you maybe be reading some excerpts when you come to Murray?
Oh, that is a good question. I may, if I am feeling particularly brave, but I'm very superstitious about works in progress. And, you know, if you expose a manuscript or a project too early, it could wither, you know. Like if you put too much sun on it, it might die. And so I wouldn't want it to crumble. So I don't think I've ever even shown it to anyone. So it would have to be a real feat of bravery, you know, for all my talk about, like, doing the scary thing. I don't know if I'm there yet.
So we'll hear you maybe read the finale to that story from Battleborn.
Yeah, maybe so. We'll see what happens in the peacock coop.
Excellent. Thank you for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.